south of the border, down Mexico way. That's where I fell in love when the stars above came out to play. And now as I wander.
Hello there, all you expat wannabes. I'm Johnny Mueller, and you're listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America, the show that tells you just what it's like to live, work, play, and or retire down here in Latin America. It's a mix of the good, the bad, the ugly, and the great, and it's all right here, so let's get started.
As you probably know, this show is coming to you between the little spare moments I have during my Expat Insider Seminar, which is taking place live right now in Guatemala and El Salvador. And today I'm going to start by telling you a nice little boots on the ground story that happened just last night. A very amusing little story that has many implications. Anyway, just last night I was in a very popular little bar disco slash restaurant in the capital of El Salvador, San Salvador, in the Zona Rosa. That's where all the activity is, all the nightlife, big hotels, first world malls, upscale business district, and some residential areas that are quite upscale too. Lots of gated, guarded communities. And it's very safe. Well, these days, all of El Salvador is very safe now that all the criminals have been locked up. In fact, I was talking to the cab driver on the way to the restaurant, and he was telling me how safe the country is now and how great it is to have a president like Bukele. He's been driving a cab, he said, 30 years. He said it's just a miracle compared to just a couple of years ago. He said it's the first time he can remember that the kids could go out and play in the yard and out in the street with the neighbors, all alone and unsupervised. He said you could even keep the doors unlocked in your house. How's that? Boy, reminds me of what the States used to be like when I was growing up. Oh, and he said lots of Salvadoranos are pissed off at international news reporters who try to beat President Bukele up in the press. He says everyone in El Salvador knows when the press dumps on Bukele internationally, calling him things like a dictator and a human rights abuser. He said it's that the other countries are jealous and envious that their crime problem's out of control. Meanwhile, a country that never got any good press at all in the past, little El Salvador, solved the problem completely and for good, all in just 2 years, performing the unheard of miracle of changing the most dangerous country in all of Latin America into the safest. Meanwhile, first world countries, with all their billions to spend on crime and enforcement, have huge, uncontrolled gang and criminal problems they just can't resolve because their leaders are either stupid, corrupt, or weak. Funny how that cab driver said it all. I couldn't add a thing. Oh, and I had another taxi driver experience that you might say was out of this world. One day I had my hotel call me a cab, and a lady picked me up. That never happened to me before in all the times I've been to El Salvador. I'd say she was in her early 30s and had some kids because there were some toys strewn around in the back and front seat of the car. I was curious and asked her how long she was driving a taxi. She said about 6 months, and I said, "Your husband doesn't mind?" She said, "You know, funny, you should ask that question." She said her husband's been driving a cab for around 5 years. And she said she always wanted to drive a cab and been bugging him for around 5 years to do it, and he would not let her drive because of the gang and the crime problems and all that. A woman driving alone? I mean, really, what guy would let his wife or girlfriend drive a cab in a country that's considered the most dangerous in Latin America? But she said her husband finally caved about 6 months ago when he realized, for the first time in something like 20 or 30 years, it wasn't dangerous for a woman to drive, day or night. She said, "I really love this job, but can you keep a secret? I drive way better than my husband." I said, "Really? What do you mean by that?" She said he must have bad eyes or something, but he's too macho to get glasses. He hits every pothole. Now, if that little story doesn't speak volumes, I don't know what does. I must have been to El Salvador 20 or 30 times in my life, and that's the first time I ever saw a woman taxi driver. By the way, I was staying at a very nice hotel, and I wanted to go out and do some power walking at night. You know, it's too hot during the day. We're in a tropical country here. And when 7 o'clock at night rolls around, it's dark. But perfect weather, because the sun's not beating on you. So I asked the guy at the hotel desk, "Is it okay to do some walking outside the grounds this time of night?" He said, "Well, I wouldn't do it if I were you." And I was kind of shocked, thinking it was so safe now. I said, "Why, is there a chance of being mugged? Is this a dangerous neighborhood at night?" He said, "Oh no, it's not that, not at all. It's just that," he said, "when you get a couple of blocks from the hotel, there are no street lights. It's pitch black. And if you're walking or running, you might step in a hole or trip over a curb and break your ankle." He said, "If you're going to run or walk at this time of night, it's at your own risk unless you take a flashlight." Well, I didn't have a real flashlight, just one of those little lights you have on your phone, and I went out walking anyway. He was right. Every so often, there'd be a block or a street corner that was pitch black. So I just kind of slowed down and walked easy. And the only time I felt any fear or anxiety whatsoever is when I saw a dog about a block away. He stopped, turned, and looked at me. And I thought, no, not going that way. So I took a left instead of a right. But I digress as usual. What I really wanted to talk about was what happened when I was at that restaurant slash disco bar, a couple of blocks down from the hotel. Now, as you may or may not know, Latin America's got all those anti-smoking rules you have up in the States. You can't smoke inside a building. That means restaurants, discos, and bars too, except a lot of the restaurants have an outdoor section, or the whole restaurant itself is sort of outdoor-indoor, with the tables in the open air but under a canopy. Now, as for me, very infrequently I'll smoke a cigar, preferably a Cuban, called a puro or habano down here. And it just so happens at the table next to me, I was at the outdoor part of the restaurant. There was a guy smoking a Cohibas cigar. You can tell by the band. You may have heard of them, Cohibas. It's one of the most expensive production cigar brands in the world. By the way, it's prohibited to sell Cuban cigars in the States. Part of that stupid Cuban embargo thing, you know. So Cuban cigars, if you can get them into the States, carry a real premium. So anyway, I noticed the guy at the table next to me smoking a Cohiba. And knowing cigars a little bit myself, I saw he was smoking a Cohiba Robusto. You know, every cigar company has maybe 10 different varieties, types, and sizes. This was called a Robusto. It's a popular Cuban cigar. It costs around $30 when you buy them in a Latin American country. You know, they're not illegal in Latin American countries, only in the States. Funny thing is, they're legal in Canada and Europe, but not in the States. Though you can get them once in a while in the States at cigar clubs and gray market, of course. But it's going to cost you. And I'd guess in the States, a gray market Robusto would probably go for $40 or $50. I know, ridiculously expensive. But even if you were to go to Cuba, direct to the Cohiba factory, you'll pay about $10 a piece for them, around $250 a box of 25. Meanwhile, back at the indoor-outdoor restaurant, there was a guy sitting all alone at the table next to me smoking a Cohiba Robusto. Now, of course, being that it was a bar disco restaurant, there was a disco part where the reggaeton music was blasting. Not so loud in the restaurant part, but still annoying.
It's always annoying.
So being that this casual-looking 30-something Latino guy was smoking a very expensive Cuban cigar, and you don't see Latinos smoking them, believe me. Maybe another brand, but not Cohibas. They're the most expensive, like I said. So I gave him the thumbs up and said kind of loud, Cohiba Robusto. Buen elección. That means nice choice. Well, he smiled, leaned over, and went into his little leather fanny pack pouch and pulled out another one and gave it to me. I was kind of shocked to get a freebie like that, especially from someone I didn't even know. I said, thanks, but are you sure? Seguro? He said, go ahead, be my guest, and took out a cigar clipper, snipped the end, and lit me up with a little propane torch. I found out over the next few minutes he was a Cuban doctor in El Salvador on contract from Castro's Cuba, working at one of the big public hospitals in San Salvador. He said he had about 1 year left on his contract and he was making his plans to stay. He just had to figure a way to get out of it, not go back. Then we got to talking about stem cells and I told him about the Cuban doctors I know that were doing stem cell therapy in the Dominican Republic, Mexico, and Panama, and he knew all about that too. By the way, the Cuban doctors at those stem cell clinics are docs that escaped too. When their contracts expired, they did not go back, which can be dangerous for your family back in Cuba. But you knew that already, right? I found out from some of the Cuban docs I know that one way to get the hell out and never go back is to marry a foreigner in the country that you're working. And Doc Carlos told me he couldn't do that because he had a wife back in Cuba. Now, I tried to pump him a bit to ask him how he's going to pull that off. He said he was working on it and he had a whole year to figure it out. He said he's already petitioned for his wife to come over on a little visit, a vacation. And if she gets permission, that's a 50-50 shot, then they'll just never go back. He did say, though, that with all the Cuban doctors around the world, there's kind of a grapevine between the ones that have escaped. So he's trying to work that network and hopeful. Aside from that, here's the real fun part of that story last night. I should tell you that that bar and disco restaurant was filled with upscale Latinos of the get down and party sort, you know. Mostly the 20 to 40 crowd and a lot of macho posers. There were just tons of well-dressed Latin guys putting on the dog. It's funny to watch these guys. They're sitting there with their dates having dinner, and then sooner or later the guy will get up to go to the bathroom and he'll chat up a good-looking girl he sees on the way to the john. Some of these guys have no shame. Oh, and by looking at the parking lot, you might think the joint was loaded with high rollers. Lots of upscale SUVs in the parking lot, some even double parked with bodyguards on the street. Of course, that doesn't mean those cars are actually paid for or that they've got money for gas. Anyway, after talking to Carlos, the Cuban doc, for about 20 minutes, a suave-looking, very well-dressed, 30-something Latin guy walks over. He says in Spanish, "Burros, habanos, me encanta," which means in English, "I love those Cuban cigars." Then he looks at me and he says, "If you've got any more, I'll buy them from you." And I said, "Don't ask me, they're his." And I pointed to the doc. And the doc said, "Sorry, pal, I've only got a few and they're not for sale." Then this slick Latino guy said, "You're Cubano, huh?" He could tell by the doc's accent. Again, this was all going down in Spanish, which is why it's so much more fun living in Latin America when you can speak Spanish. How in the hell are you going to have real salt-of-the-earth conversations like that? Anyway, then the guy said to the doc, "If you've got another one, I'll give you $100 for it." Well, the doc paused a second, looked at me, I gave him a positive nod. Like, go for it, doc. He unzipped his fanny pack and pulled out his last Cohiba Robusto. And the slick Latin guy, still standing right next to us, opened his little satchel, just big enough for us to see he had a nice stack of bills in there. All hundreds. He peeled one off, handed it to the doc, and the doc gave him a cigar. He put it under his nose, gave it a big whiff, said thanks and adios, see you guys around, walked out into the parking lot, got into a big SUV, didn't start it up, didn't turn on a light, just was sitting in there, smoking that cigar. Now, you have to remember, the place is really busy. People walking in and out, all the tables filled, the parking lot filled, hot guys, girls, and couples walking every which way. And you know, here in Latin America, it's really hard to tell who's rich and poor when you're in the business or party district, and everyone's out and about dressed to kill. Of course, you know, the guys with the SUVs and bodyguards have money. Well, they appear to have money anyway. Though it's really hard to tell who's broke and who's not, because everyone's putting on the dog. And as far as that Cuban doc, Carlos, you know, he's not rich. He's got nothing. He's making a doctor's salary, which is something like $500 or $600 a month. And so he asked me a favor. He said, "Look, I'd like to get some change for this $100, and I can't just walk up to the bar. They won't give me change unless I buy a drink, and a drink is $6. He said, "You don't happen to have change for $100, do you?" Now, remember, we're in El Salvador. It's one of the only other countries in the world that uses the U.S. dollar as its regular currency, so dollars are everywhere. Of course, they take Bitcoin, too, and the bar, restaurant, disco had little QR codes everywhere that said, "We accept Bitcoin." Very cool. The fact is, everywhere you go in El Salvador, you see signs and stickers for Bitcoin everywhere. And the Chivo and Lightning apps, too. Those are the apps you use for very small purchases, like drinks, cups of coffee, Coca-Cola, junk food, and other poisons. I'm sure you've probably heard of the Lightning app. It's for doing quick, instant transactions for small stuff. So you don't have to go into your Bitcoin wallet all the time. You just load, let's say, $100 worth of Bitcoin in your Lightning or Chivo wallet, and you spend that around town instead of your Bitcoin, which is much more of a hassle and sometimes takes 5 or 10 minutes to process, whereas the Lightning and Chivo apps are instantaneous. They're called second layer apps. They're a second layer on top the Bitcoin blockchain. But you knew that already, right? Anyway, I knew that Cuban doc seemed a little hard up for cash, so I said, "Sure, I'll change your $100. Well, he handed it to me, and instantly, I kind of felt there was something wrong with it. It didn't feel right. So I went into my hidden passport pouch, pulled out $100, and compared the two. Sure enough, his was a little bit different. Different weight to the paper or something. I said, "Doc, I think you got stiffed." He said, "Wait a minute, give it to me." And I gave him back his $100 and a real $100 from my pouch. He studied them both for 30 seconds or more and said, "A la gran puta." I said, "What are you going to do now?" I mean, look, the guy who passed him the fake was still in his car in the parking lot. And depending on what Doc Carlos was deciding to do about it, could surely have changed the way that night was going to end up. And believe me, at that moment, I wasn't feeling too calm and collected myself. I just didn't want to be too close by when the shit hit the fan, if you know what I mean. And just then, at that moment, Doc Carlos started laughing. And I thought, that's nice. He's taking it pretty good. I thought to myself, I don't think I'd have been laughing if I was out a $50 cigar. Just then, the doc turned to me and said, "It's okay, no harm done. That Cuban cigar was fake, too." I said, "What?" He said, "In Cuba, you could buy those fake Cohiba Robustos on the street for $3 a piece all day long." And I said to him, "So, really? Well, then I guess everybody's happy, right?" "That's a good thing then, right? We just go our separate ways." And he winked and said, "Not so fast. I'm going to go get a drink." what are you drinking? I'll buy you one. And he went up into that loud, noisy, dank bar and bought two $6 drinks with that $100 bill, and he got $88 in change. He came back, handed me my drink, downed his in practically one gulp, said adios, shook my hand, and left. The next thing I thought was, maybe I should leave too. After all, they had cameras posted here and there. Hell, even Latin America is starting to get loaded up with cameras. Of course, that doesn't mean anyone's really mining the store or watching the monitors.
Or that they actually work.
I've been in plenty of places, even supposedly very secure places like banks. I've walked past the guard or monitoring station and the guy's asleep at the wheel. And sometimes a number of the camera squares on the screen are blacked out. In other words, some just aren't working. So that's pretty much the state of cameras and high tech when it comes to monitoring people here in Latin America. But still, I just wasn't feeling too good about hanging around that place. Not with that guy still in his car in the parking lot. So I was out of there in about 5 minutes, too. After all, you could say I was an accessory to the crime. But still, you know, a cigar lasts a long time, right? And soon enough, I too realized Doc Carlos was right about those cigars not being real. They were counterfeits. Mine was not burning right, because a real expensive Cuban cigar burns so smooth and even. And this thing, after a few minutes, was sort of burning itself down the side, looking kind of lopsided. Oh well, like Doc Carlos said, no harm done. Now, Doc Carlos, being he's from Cuba, who's only been in the last year thrown into the larger pond of capitalism, we can excuse him for not asking that slick Latin guy to pay that $100 in Bitcoin. Since it's impossible to counterfeit Bitcoin, due to the fact that every single Bitcoin, fraction of Bitcoin, Satoshis, and transactions are all on the blockchain. Locatable and traceable forever. I kind of wonder what would have happened if Doc Carlos would have asked for payment in Bitcoin. So much for the woulda, coulda, shouldas, huh? All right, moving on. Remember a couple of shows ago, I read that email from one of our ladies in the U.S. military. Well, you know, since I read that email, the floodgates were opened. Meaning I got a slew of other emails from military people who also prefer to remain anonymous. A lot of that going around, huh? Can't blame them, though. And somewhere buried in practically every one of those emails was a statement saying they just have to keep quiet. They have no platform to air their grievances and wouldn't if they could. And though in the lamestream media, you might hear about general dissatisfaction with the armed forces regarding all things woke. Still, no one wants to talk about it on the record. So I thought, why not give them a bit of a platform once again today? After all, quite a few of our military personnel have expressed interest in getting the hell out of Dodge, getting that Plan B going once they get out of the military. And hell, I've had quite a few ex-military guys and gals come to my Expat Insider Seminar with the expressed intention of getting the hell out of Dodge. So, without any further ado, or a don't, let me read parts of this email that just came in from one of our female ladies in uniform. She entitles it, Why Our Military is So Woke, and Why They Won't Do Anything About It. She starts out, Johnny, I have some choice words for the leadership that now runs our armed forces. She says, we no longer care about lethality because everything is now televised. We no longer have the ability to look more than 2 or 3 years down the line because our military commanders swap out every 24 to 36 months. And when a new commander comes, the cycle starts over again. She says, Johnny, woke agendas in the military are pushed from the top down because Washington insiders shape military policy to show the American people that they're progressively moving ahead. She says, imagine if the World War II Dresden bombing was filmed in real time and presented on CNN, or if the destruction of Hiroshima and Nagasaki had occurred when Twitter was around. She says, in that case, the outright disgust of the American people would trump the effectiveness of those operations. She says, the Dresden bombing was considered a success to some historians, and to others, the complete bombing of this city is still debated as if it was a war crime. And that was World War II, before social media. Today, she says, with any military action, we have to worry about the hearts and minds of not only the American public, but the countries that we are taking by force for, quote, democracy, unquote. She says, women are now allowed to be in combat arms, like in the infantry and the Rangers. Don't get me wrong, I think women should be allowed to join the armed forces, but the science behind these women in these positions does not back up what our policy says. We must do. Recently, the Army created a gender-neutral and ageless physical fitness test, but it was scrapped
because, surprise, surprise,
women were unable to pass while the men passed easily. She says women are much more likely to be injured and in the field they can't carry as much as a man. Women also become pregnant, which means they are out of the gun line for at least a year because of pregnancy and recovery. And when you lose a person for a year in a fire team or similar situation, it's not good for readiness, especially when these people need to work as a team and be accustomed to the other person's movements and reactions. She says women who wind up pregnant are put on a different physical profile. No heavy lifting, no going to the gun range, and so forth. They get to work in areas that require sitting at a desk, so they're lower in readiness. And now, the military is allowing people with HIV to be in combat zones.
We all realize in combat, this is dangerous.
Yes, medical service personnel wear gloves, but I should not have to worry about cross-contamination of a deadly disease if I'm simply helping my injured battle buddy. She says if you ask most soldiers,
they'll tell you they're against it, that it shouldn't be allowed.
She says the armed forces has been inclusive for a long while. For almost 80 years now, take my grandfather, who commandeered an interracial unit when he was fighting in Korea. Women have been equal in pay in the armed forces since the 1970s, too. However, generals and admirals parrot what politicians want because, yes, they do want those revolving door defense jobs when they retire, but they also want to be funded. Without agreeing to those ideas, your project or improvements may not be funded. Personally, I don't even think those at the top even care about the damage they're doing to the armed forces. After all, they'll retire and be out of it soon enough. Another issue seldom spoken about is that while our officer and NCO corps are more educated these days, on paper anyway, that doesn't mean we are as intelligent as our forefathers were. She says West Point is a clear indicator. According to stats from the U.S. War College, between 1973 and 1990, West Point had cadets in equal caliber as the students from Harvard and Penn State. The military keeps meticulous records of cadets back since standardized testing began in the 40s. And it definitely appears the officer corps are being dumbed down. And now, as the Army has also been forced to have, quote, diversity hires at West Point and the military academies as to not appear to be racist, West Point candidates are now on par with Ohio State student candidates, no longer the students from Harvard or Penn State like before. By the way, she supports that with a link she included here from usmadata.com entitled Army Officer Testing Decline Stats. So if you want a copy of that, send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. Then she has a note about transgender soldiers here. She says, the notion we need to welcome those with HIV and body dysmorphia in our ranks and to change the whole policy for people who make up a tenth of a percent of the population is mind-boggling. She says, did you know that people in the U.S. are banned from enlisting just because they had childhood asthma, yet trans soldiers that cost thousands of extra dollars in medical costs a year and require lifelong care are admitted? Though on a positive note, she says, luckily, those who fought against the COVID vaccine jab were reinstated as of a few months ago with back pay and their records wiped clean. She says, Johnny, people are afraid to speak out against these woke policies in the Army. Because the Army stands for equal opportunity, if you don't agree with trans people in the Army, you're going against policy and could possibly be discharged. So people are afraid to speak up. She says some people might say that diversity is our strength, but that can only be accomplished when people are united and become as one unit. The problem is when your race and gender come before you being a soldier. Soldiering should be your number one priority. However, we're regressing. Then she says, sorry about my rant, Johnny. It's just hard to get our mission done when there are so many internal roadblocks. Well, there you have it, folks. What's in the minds of most soldiers yet left unspoken? For obvious reasons. And you know, what I like about this particular email is that she backed it up with links, proving everything she stated and more. So if you disagree or doubt any of that stuff, send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com, and I'll send those links on to you, and you can check them out for yourself. And man, I'll tell you, I read those links, and after you're done reading them, you really have your doubts about the morale in the military, and morale is everything, right? All right, moving on. Now, since those two big earthquakes in Turkey about 3 weeks ago, about a week apart, seven pointers, right? Well, since then, emails have been trickling in. What about earthquakes in Central and South America? Should we be worried? I mean, in Turkey, over 50,000 people died in those two quakes. And according to press reports, over 200,000 buildings crumbled or are unrepairable now. Well, the thing is, there's a big, big difference between what happened in Turkey and what's happened in Guatemala, Mexico, Peru, Costa Rica, and all the earthquake zones in Central and South America. Down here in Latin America, every time a new building is built, plans are drawn up by a certified architect and registered at the local municipality. They get checked over to see if they meet the seismic codes. Only then are they built. In fact, they're mostly overbuilt. And when there's an earthquake, the buildings you see that are damaged in the media are the ones that did not go through that process. It's always squatters' homes and people who build without permits who get damaged. They're the ones that build on unstable land that's free, like on sides of volcanoes. Of course, a death is a death according to the newspaper, so when 200 people die, let's say, they almost never mention their squatters and the land was never zoned for residential use. Whereas with the recent earthquakes in Turkey, it's a completely different story. It all started in 2018 ahead of President Erdogan's election. Turns out Turkey's urban planning commissions discovered that there were tens of thousands of buildings constructed in violation of urban planning laws and seismic codes. So, in order to get reelected and legalize the non-conforming buildings, Erdogan passed an amnesty law. And under that law, owners could legalize non-conforming buildings by filing an online application and paying a tax. No remodeling, reinforcing, or inspections necessary. Just file online and pay a tax. And in that amnesty, there's no mention of a requirement for independent assessment of each building. However, the law stipulates the owner is responsible for ensuring that his building was earthquake resistant. It was the honor system. Ha ha. Now, get this. Turkish authorities extended that amnesty several times. The move generated billions of dollars in taxes for state coffers. More than 3 million houses and buildings received that amnesty. That was 3 million houses and buildings in violation of seismic codes. So if you're wondering why over 100,000 buildings collapsed and almost 80,000 people died, it was because over a third of the buildings in Turkey were not built to seismic codes. All they had to do was fill out a form and pay a tax. So if you're wondering, there are no such amnesty laws in Central or South America. South of the border. You've been listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America. If you need some help with your own Plan B, we can schedule a one-on-one phone or Skype consult. Just send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. And if you want to get on the waiting list for my next week-long Expat Insider Seminar in Central America, where you're guaranteed to get a 2 to 5 year head start on your Plan B, send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. Nos vemos.